Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and we host Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles.
We might look at Beatles albums, we might tell you what books you need to be taking on holiday. We've done an episode from Abbey Road Studios, and we do live shows.
We've also had guests on our podcast, like Beatles biographer Mark Lewison and singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock. Search for Nothing Is Real on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Available 8 days a week.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. This is the second part of our Beatles at Christmas episodes. And in the first part, we looked at the Christmases from 1960 to 1964 and how the Beatles went from being despondent about the future on the back of Hamburg to being the all-conquering pop and rock music champions of the world.
Toppermost of the
poppermost. They had kept true to that promise by December 1964. So we're going to look at the back end of the 1960s now, because as we signed off with the last time, there aren't really any more mountains left to climb once they get to the end of 1964. And, I think out of all the rock stars in the world, you can almost forgive the Beatles for taking the diversion into drugs, because they need to turn inwards and find out more about what's going on. When you get to the topmost of the poppermost, maybe there's nothing there.
Except drugs
and spirituality and all the things that kind
that
of...
That would follow.
that kind of attract... that attract rock stars. So let's look into December 1965. And at this point, they are about to put out the Rubber Soul album. So they've made that album very, very quickly. And that album's going to be coming out and number one for Christmas. They're going to put out the simultaneous double A-side We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper. And that's going to be a Christmas number one as well. But they're also in December 1965 doing their last set of UK gigs. And that's kind of a, it's an odd time for them to be touring the UK.
They're still doing the circuit.
Yes.
They're doing the UK circuit. And, by this stage, they played these enormous concerts in America, and now they're back to playing 2,000-3,000 seat
theatres.
And because simply the venues don't exist in England. So, again, we're back to this notion of... The kind of conflict or the tension between their getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. England, that touring circuit, they've really outgrown that.
Yes.
They're about to produce an album which is really the last album that they can tour in terms of the songs and being able to replicate.
Yeah.
From this point on, they start to sort of get into the studio.
Yeah.
So again, there's that constant tension, and whether it always seems to come to the fore at this time of year.
Well, Christmas can bring out the best and the worst in all of us. But what's interesting is, at that time they are putting out We Can Work It Out, which apparently they play on that UK tour.
Yes, it makes a set list on a couple of occasions, but then it gets dropped. And this was something that came up on Twitter.
Yes.
People saying, there's no live recording of that song.
Yes.
If you go onto YouTube, there's what purports to be a live recording.
But we don't know if it's fake.
We don't know if that's fake.
It's apparently, we think, the only song the Beatles recorded live that we don't have a proper live recording of,
yep,
or that the Beatles played live, certainly in their famous years, or certainly the only Lennon McCartney song that we don't have a live recording of.
And again, what you've got is this phenomenal work rate.
Yes.
And this is probably again the pinnacle of that. So they are really up against it to record the
Rubber
album,
Soul,
get the album out for Christmas. At the same time, they think, yeah, but we're still going to stay true to this idea of having a standalone
single as well.
Single.
Because they're still playing the old rock and roll standards and Long Tall Sally's and all the rest. But it's interesting because at the start of that tour, there's kind of almost a metaphor for what goes on. So they're driving down the road, and I think Neil is driving at the time, and somebody says, "Oh, you dropped a banjo off the back." And what's the story there?
So this is their show. I mean, again, and this is again an indication of what it was like to be touring in England. So George says later, 14 guitars strapped to the roof of our Austin Princess. And so you just have this crazy picture of an Austin Princess, guitar strapped to the roof. Alf Bicknell, their chauffeur, is travelling up the M1. Somebody flags him down. He goes back, and by the time he gets back to it, the guitar is just matchwood. And this is George's Gretsch Country Gentleman guitar. And, you know, George is making the point and saying, oh, you know, people say, don't worry about it, you could buy as many guitars as you want. But he said, this is a guitar to which he had a real emotional attachment. So that's the start. That's how their tour starts.
And it is funny that, as you say, that's how they are touring at that time, that they're still travelling in cars. There's not really a whole lot of comfort to what's going on at that time. So yeah, so getting back to that issue of, you know, what songs were they playing at the time? We're just pulling up a quick list here. You know, they're playing, okay, they're doing Nowhere Man, they're doing We Can Work It Out, they're doing Day Tripper on that tour, they're doing Help, which is from earlier in 65, but they're still also doing, they're finishing up with I'm Down and Act Naturally and all the rest. So it's still a bit of a, it's not a total reflection of, you know, when you look back to December 1965 as a fan, you kind of think, oh yes, they were all getting very progressive, but they're still playing these provincial theatres, travelling in, you know, Austin cars up and down the motorways, the nascent motorway network of the UK. And, you know, it's not a comfortable way of life. They do not have a Christmas show in 1965, but they do play two gigs in London, in the Hammersmith Odeon, and also in the Finsbury Park again. But actually, for this time round, they're taking Christmas off, but they still put out another Christmas record, the third, what's called the Beatles' third Christmas record. And this is a slightly, you could say it's a weary beast, or a slightly more cynical record,
so.
Maybe compared to the other ones.
Yeah, it has an odd sort of gestation here, because what happened, it was generally sort of October seems to be the time they start directing their thoughts to recording a Christmas records. So they have a false start mid-October, October the 19th. They go to London's Marquee Studio.
Which I don't think they were ever in any other time, were they?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But I'm not quite sure why they aren't in Studio 2.
Mm-hmm.
But this is about a week into the recording of Rubber Soul. And the interesting thing for me here is that they start working on sketches around the idea of a pirate radio station.
Right.
And that's the initial the initial conceit behind it. But the whole thing doesn't work for some reason.
But thankfully, The Who were able to stretch that out for an entire album about 18 months later.
But for some reason, they're just not kind of feeling it. It's just not working. And again, harking back to that point I said previously, the workload that they have at the minute in 1965 is just phenomenal. And maybe that's what's taking its toll. But it's all a bit aimless. Then they start again on the 8th of November. They're in Abbey Road. They're working on Think for Yourself, the George Harrison track. And George Martin thinks a lot of kind of studio banter here. I'll just keep the tape running, see if there's anything salvageable here. This doesn't really work either.
Mm.
But that studio banter has an interesting afterlife.
Yeah, tell me about that, because we were talking about this a little while ago. I didn't realise. I remember at the time that the snippets of them harmonising on Think for Yourself, they turn up in a blink and you'll miss it moment in the Yellow Submarine cartoon in 1968.
Yes.
Which gives George license to put Think for Yourself on the Yellow Submarine soundtrack
yeah.
in 1999.
Yeah.
So that comes from that kind of back and forth chat, and that's in the Lewison recording sessions. He talks
yes.
about that, but it then has another afterlife.
So 2001, there's an album comes out called Liverpool Sound Collage.
Yes.
And this is an album that's credited to Paul McCartney, The Beatles, Super Furry Animals and Youth.
Yes.
And this is an album that comes out after the first two Fireman
mm-hmm.
Records that McCartney has done with Youth. But this was Peter Blake, who did the Pepper cover, asked McCartney if he could sort of come up with something with a kind of Liverpool influence.
Mm.
And at the time, I remember this being kind of trumpeted as a you know, there's a Beatles track that's unreleased.
Beatles on this.
But what it is this studio chat that's sort of interwoven into various other bits and pieces. So you've got a track that's credited to Super Furry Animals. You've got bits of McCartney's Liverpool Oratorio with McCartney wandering around the streets of Liverpool with a microphone saying, what do you think about the Beatles? And doing like a box pop.
It's a very... Like from his TV special.
It's a very odd... album. I remember rushing out to buy the CD thinking this was going to be some amazing unreleased Beatles track. It's an interesting thing if you come across it. I couldn't say it's not official canon. It's not something I would rush out to.
Yeah, it is an odd curio, but it does have the Beatles name on it and it does have the Beatles in it.
And it was nominated for the 2001 Grammy Award for Best Alternative Music Album.
Do we know?
It didn't win.
Do we know who did win?
I don't know who won, but people can write in on a postcard.
But yeah, it is an interesting thing. And I remember when the Pepper Box came out, there was a bit that was like, I know that, which is the Free Now bit.
Yeah, so Free Now is a track on this album.
Yeah.
And it's Take 9 of Sgt. Pepper, the title track.
Where Paul's just kind of extemporizing Free Now. So if you've, you know, it's chances are more people listening to this have heard the Pepper outtakes than heard Liverpool Sound Collage, but you can go back to Liverpool Sound Collage and it's all back there.
Yes, and that led on to McCartney working with Super Furry Animals on a track.
Yes,
which again has a kind of throwback to another earlier 60s track.
It's a Brian Wilson, he's eating a carrot or a vegetable.
That's it. So there's a song called, it's on Rings Around the World, and there's a song called Receptacle for the Respectable.
Yes.
And they asked Paul, would he come in and chew a carrot and some celery to provide a kind of percussion track, which is what he had done on
for Brian Wilson. It is a great song, Receptacle for the Respectable, but you'd be listening pretty hard before you'll hear Paul McCartney on it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it is a great song. So it's funny how all these things, all these roads go back to December 1965.
But this is the one I think I like least.
Mm-hmm. Because, the Christmas record.
This is the Christmas record. This is just the kind of it sounds totally random.
Yeah.
They're singing Yesterday, this kind of off key version of Yesterday, which I wonder, are they kind of, you know, making fun of McCartney, or just how successful that song had been, you know, big hit single in America as well. Plus it's a kind of McCartney solo track, and the rest of them, you know, George used to introduce Yesterday as a, you know, opportunity knocks for Mr. Paul McCartney. And
well, we could almost do a whole podcast on Yesterday, and maybe that's on the future list. But it's interesting again how Yesterday becomes, even though it wasn't a single in the UK, it becomes this kind of focus for attention. And
certainly it opens and it closes this Christmas record, but in between it's totally random. There's a sort of slightly aggressive tone. And although they must have been happy to be making the Christmas record, you kind of feel there's maybe an undercurrent of resentment. They do a parody of Eve of Destruction.
Yes.
On it. And they suddenly break into Same Old Song.
And they have to, there's a copyright
thing. And then somebody goes, oh, it's copyright, you have to stop that. But, you know, it's maybe reading too much into it to say that was a kind of comment on what was happening at the time.
Yeah.
But really, this was the point at which I think, as you said in the introduction, they have to sort of turn inward, and they're going to go into the studio. This can't continue.
Yes.
This is the point, it cannot continue. And there's much less, I suppose, Christmas bonhomie about this recording.
And if you look at Christmas 1965, Day Tripper and Week of Working Out is number one, Rubber Soul is number one in the UK. In the USA, the number one single is actually, do you know what it is? It's Over and Over by the Dave Clark Five.
Okay.
And but interestingly enough, in January 66, We Can Work It Out battles for number one with The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
So they're back and forth. They're up and down to number one. And the number one US album at the end of 1965 is Whipped Cream and Other Delights by Herb Albert.
Can we touch briefly on just this idea that they're changing and they're sort of pushing back slightly, is the third film?
Oh, yes.
So at this point, it's A Talent for Loving is mooted as the third film, and that's still being talked about. Epstein has bought the rights to this.
Yeah.
And it's in the middle of December. John, Paul, George have a meeting on the 13th of December to discuss the third film and basically say, it's not happening.
Yeah.
We're not doing it. So again, this is them pushing back. against Epstein. So up to this point, I suppose between 1961 and now, Epstein is setting out the template for what's happening.
Yes.
It's that kind of showbizzy style thing. He's described as sort of smarting slightly that they won't do the 65 Christmas panto.
Yep.
They've moved beyond that. But his focus is still on theater and panto and Christmas and traditional.
But it is interesting that, you know, they have, you know, the Beatles sort of had this talent for not doing things a second time. But there are a couple of things they did a second time. And we mentioned in part one how, you know, they went back to Hamburg at the end of 62. That seemed odd. They're still going back to provincial theatres. They're still going back to do films. There's a couple of things that do get repeated, but they do end up in them. You know, you could almost say at the same time that the live shows and the movies are both getting pushed back at the same time.
It's this idea that they've got to be moving ahead.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened, allegedly, on the 13th of December is presumably having just rejected the idea of a film.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney takes LSD
for the first time. Yes. Now, John and George had already taken LSD earlier in 65 with their dentist, of course. You do.
They've all done that.
Ringo had taken LSD in the summer at a party in California, I think. But Paul, sensible Paul, had been a bit... he talks about it being like a type of peer pressure, and the worst peer pressure because it's three Beatles against you. But he does eventually relent.
He does. And the story is that they finish their final UK tour.
And they do their last ever UK gig in December 65 in Cardiff.
Cardiff, which is the question I got wrong
at the recent Beat the Brain of Ireland
quiz. So thank you for reminding me of that. So they're celebrating the end of the tour, and they go to the Scotch of St. James nightclub. And the next night, John and McCartney go back, and they're there with John Entwistle, who I'm sure was a moderating influence. And towards the end of the evening, Lennon, perhaps oddly, sort of peels off and goes home. Mm-hmm. McCartney... and a guy called Viv Prince, who was the drummer or the former drummer in the Pretty Things, they go on to another venue, as does Tara Brown.
Yes, and we'll come back to Tara Brown.
We'll come back. But he's effectively a sort of part of the Guinness family. And this is in the Barry Miles book, many years from now, McCartney says, you know, I thought, well, this is as good a time as any. So I said, go on then, fine. So we all did it. And he's kind of quite matter of fact in that book about it was like, oh, yeah, so then, yeah, okay, let's do it. But that must have been really quite a significant moment for him, because not only the sort of the mind expanding effect of the drug, but this kind of, he's crossing a line, he's held out against this, and you kind of do get the sense, you know, Lennon is just prepared to take anything and will push it even back as far as Hamburg. He's the one that's doing the most drugs, so if someone's taking a speed, he's going to take twice as much. Harrison is kind of, it's the sort of spiritual side. McCartney is the man who's always in control.
Yes.
Always conscious of the public image. So it must be quite a step for him to do, to take that.
And in the end, he doesn't do it with the other Beatles as well, which is
Yeah, that's interesting, you know? As well. And I mean, I suppose, is it just it was an opportunistic thing that, oh, the situation arose? Or did the fact that there were no other Beatles there, did that help him?
Yes.
You know, that he was doing this outside.
Well, the other thing was they, you know, for once, they are not working across the Christmas. So he has a little bit of free time.
Yes.
You know, he probably says, well, I can take tomorrow off this if I feel a bit unwell.
Yeah.
But, you know, they are not working right up to Christmas Day. Once they play that last gig on December the 12th, they're kind of lying low for the rest of 65, aren't they? So he kind of has a bit of a leeway to do it. But we mentioned Tara Brown there, who's going to crop up on a couple of other key events. And the other key event is on the 26th of December 1965, which was a Sunday, Boxing Day or Stephen's Day or whatever part of the world you're in. You know, a kind of a key event happens that casts an odd long shadow, which is that Paul is up in Liverpool for Christmas. He is with Tara Brown, and Tara Brown at this stage I think is 20 years old. As you said, he is the heir. He's due to inherit like a seven-figure family dowry from the Guinness family fortune, but he is a high society London socialite, and his life is covered in a great recent book by Irish author Paul Howard called I Read the News Today. Oh boy.
Fantastic book. If anybody hasn't read that, it's now a paperback edition. I really recommend you pick that up.
It's a top book. And so for the 26th of December, Paul is up on a moped with Tara Brown. They're both on a moped each. They're pegging it around the Wirral in Liverpool. Who knows whether drink has been taken. But Paul then sort of has a just basically bicycle crash. He just comes flying off his bicycle. And then, so what's the end result of that?
Well, the end result is, or the immediate result is he chips a tooth.
But yeah, he talks about it in the anthology book where he's riding along on mopeds with Tara, showing him the Liverpool scenery. And he says, suddenly he has a freeze frame motion and he ends up on the ground looking up at the moon. And he says he had a slow motion moment where he said to himself, I'm going to hit the pavement with my face. And then he was bringing Tara Brown over to his cousin's house, and it turns around that the cousin or somebody put a stitch into Paul's lip, which is odd when you think about, you know, face is his fortune.
They could get a doctor. And someone said actually as Paul has aged, you can see that scar kind of pulling slightly on the lip. So if you notice it sort of from the sort of late 70s on, he has a slight kind of twist to that upper lip, which is maybe the scar.
So the motorbike crash also kind of feeds into the Paul is dead myth this is apparently the thing that killed Paul
at this point and was replaced by Paul.
But that's not true.
Well,
it's a myth, Stephen.
Is
it's
it true? True? Perhaps that's something we need to look at in more detail
in a future episode.
In a future episode.
Maybe we do. So Christmas 1965, another time of change. They're not working so hard. Let's skip forward now to December 1966. And by December 1966, they are in, again, a totally different space. They have played their last ever paying live performance in Candlestick Park in August. There's a period of quiet. It's been announced that there is no Beatles Christmas album. There is no Beatles Christmas single. They put out the collection of Beatles oldies that we talked about on a previous episode for Christmas. And the Beatles also, for Christmas week, they take the front page of the NME and put up an ad wishing everyone a happy Christmas.
No tour.
And there's no tour. There's no Bishish tour. There's kind of articles in the press. Are they splitting up? What's going on? But what is happening... once they come back from their post-Candlestick Park hiatus, where Lennon's making a film and Paul's doing his stuff, is that they go back to Abbey Road and they start working on a famous suite of songs.
So Strawberry Fields and When I'm 64, these are the first songs that they're working on as part of the sessions that would lead into Pepper. And as you say, at this point, it's the lack of product, the lack of visibility, the fact that each of them is doing something separate.
Yeah,
it's fueling that kind of press.
Yes,
speculation.
And so, in December '66, they are back ensconced in Abbey Road, and it's time to talk about the Christmas record again. The Christmas record this year is a totally different beast from the three previous Christmas records. It's the fourth Christmas record, and it has a title. It's called Pantomime Everywhere It's Christmas. And it is a pantomime. It's like a little goon-style proto-Monty Python radio play thing.
It is. I think this is probably my favourite Beatles Christmas record, because it's that they're using George Martin to bring that same kind of sensibility that he brought to the Goons to this. So it's scripted, it's got sound effects, it's got music, it's got a kind of very weird narrative of sorts.
Yes.
And this is recorded the day after they've recorded the first take
of Strawberry Fields. Yeah, recorded in Dick James' studio on Friday, November the 25th, 66.
Yeah. So what they do is they go and watch this new American guy, guitar player at the Bag of Nails, which Jimmy,
what was his name? Did
Jimmy,
he go on?
Jimmy Hendrix.
Oh my word!
They go and see him. That's his UK debut, and then they gather in the Dick James studio to tape
this record. Everyone's Christmas. And so that comes out as the fan club flexi, and it's a very funny, charming, very different type. There's none of this thanks to all the fans.
That's the thing. It's they've abandoned the kind of Tony Barrow. You've got to thank everybody. You've got to do this. Is also they're performing little characters, so they're not really appearing as themselves.
They're kind of echoing,
I suppose what they do is they're going to become not the Beatles, they're going to become Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Candles, matches.
If anyone wants to check, it's very funny. I mean, it genuinely is a very funny. If you're tuned into the Goons and then what would become Monty Python, and I think you know there's a lot of what's happening on this record and the next one prefigures Python.
Yes,
for me. But yes, Pudgy the Bear and Jasper are my favorite. And also there are little songs in here. One of which, the unreleased Beatles classic, "Please Don't Bring Your Banjo Back." I don't know where it's been. So again, it's they're sort of subverting that whole music hall pantomime.
Yeah.
Idea. They're putting it onto the record. There's no Christmas show. There's no Christmas tour. They're acting here.
And for that month in the studio, you know, they spend an awful lot of time on Strawberry Fields and When I'm 64. And then at the end of the month, they bring in Penny Lane just right after Christmas Day. But the other striking thing that happens is on Sunday, the 18th of December, Tara Brown, who's now 21, dies in a car accident.
Mm.
And this is the car accident that is reported to be the car accident referred to in A Day in the Life.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, when you put the timeline together, you think this was a guy they knew, and he has this kind of very striking death where he, to quote the song, he went through a red light. He didn't notice the lights had changed, and he collides with a vehicle, and he swerves the car, and his passenger survives, but he dies.
Yes.
Instantly.
So his girlfriend of the time is in the car, and Lennon says, you know, I was writing A Day in the Life. I had the Daily Mail popped up in front of me on the piano, and there were various stories. And how Lennon describes it, he says one was about the Guinness heir who killed himself in a car.
Mm.
So Lennon, much less close
than Paul.
Than Paul. You know, Paul and Tara Brown had a very close relationship at that point. You know, Paul would say, you know, oh yes, that we kind of wrote that together. We had some kind of input here. But it's a kind of lasting legacy.
Yes.
to Tara Brown, who was sort of at the center of the swinging 60s, that whole kind of slightly aristocratic social scene that was whirling around, that these working class rock stars like the Stones and the Beatles were sort of suddenly mixing with this
well, there's a great book, You Threw My Way, which was what called Ready, Steady, Go by Levy,
yes, Sean Levy, yeah.
And which kind of accounts for that, you know, this kind of melting pot from, you know, the UK classes, of how, you know, royalty would be mixing with, you know, photographers, hairdressers,
yes,
all these are the kind of traditional trades that kind of commingle in the 60s. And so the notion of a multimillionaire family socialite and, you know, the son of a cotton trader from Liverpool being friends just seemed like normal for the times.
Yes, I think so. And again, it's this notion he almost sort of epitomizes that London swinging 60s, the kind of good-looking young man, lots of money, an attractive girlfriend, sports cars, hanging around with rock stars. You know, he's kind of like the poster boy, I suppose.
And so the Beatles are still at work. So even 2 days later, there's a famous bit of footage that's recorded on the 20th of December, which I really like, which is the ITN, independent television news reporter, who's stopping the Beatles on the steps as they go up into Abbey Road, and it's in black and white, and he stops them one at a time to ask them, you know, what are you doing? To try and pop the bubble of, is it over? Are you dried up? What's going on? And so he kind of meets the Beatles one by one. So he meets John first, and John's pretty chipper.
He's pretty chipper. He's got, you know, bundle of LPs under his arm, and he's saying, oh, we've done individual projects this year, but, you know, good relationship, and we're not going to tour, but, you know, Paul and I, we're going to write songs forever.
And then Paul turns up with Mal Evans and he says he's kind of, they're fed up with touring and, you know, they didn't think they could perform well. So that's where that narrative starts. Or
yes.
We can't hear ourselves.
Yes,
we can't
yes. So, and again, this is a sort of staged, this is arranged that they will be speaking to the reporters as they
arrive. He doesn't doorstep them. They know he's going to be there and they've agreed to meet him. Yes.
Having said that, George is next.
And then George is...
Is quite grumpy.
What a surprise.
He simply goes, we're not splitting up, and kind of runs off.
Yeah, he just runs into the studio. But he has a good moustache in that, if memory serves. Yeah. And then Ringo arrives with Neil Aspinall and he speaks for the longest and he's just lovely. He wishes everyone a happy Christmas down into the camera and he signs autographs and, you know, he's totally cool.
And says everything. He's not bored and...
Yes.
Yeah, so again, it's interesting that they felt the need to do this. They felt the need to...
check in with everyone.
Check in, but also to sort of, don't worry, because we're not touring, just because there isn't a record, just because there isn't a single, don't worry, we all like each other and we've done our own things, but we'll be forever together.
Yes, and that interview goes out on the 28th of December, and in the back of their minds they must be thinking, ho ho, Paula said, you know, just wait to see what we've got.
We know what we've got up our sleeve sort of thing, we know what's coming.
12 months later again, Christmas 1967, it is a totally different world once again for the Beatles. And it is their first Christmas without Brian Epstein. And that's probably reflected in what they put out at Christmas 1967. It is the Christmas of Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
But they still also manage to put out their fifth Beatles Christmas record, which is the one that might be best known, which is Christmas Time Is Here Again, which is a track that in its unedited form appeared on a B-side of Free As A Bird back in 1995.
Yes.
And it's a good track, Christmas Time Is Here Again. You know?
It is. I mean, it's a full-blown, you know, lyrically a bit sparse, but it's a full-blown production.
Yeah, it's a full-blown Beatles production. And it's interesting that although we have these fan club records, we don't really have a Beatles Christmas standard along the lines of Happy Christmas, War Is Over or Wonderful Christmas Time that we have every year. So Christmas Time Is Here Again is probably if you're doing a mix CD, it's probably the only Beatles Christmassy song you could stick on.
It does remind me of Hello Goodbye.
Okay.
The arrangement. I don't know why. Maybe it's the end, the little kind of outro of
and
Hello Goodbye.
The drums are recorded.
But it's an interesting, you know, I think if it had been put out as a Christmas single, it would probably have gone to number one, simply because it was the Beatles. But, you know, I think it's a standalone track. It's interesting. It's got a full production, which has never really been done before. For a Beatles record.
And interestingly, it says on the back of the Beatles' fifth Christmas record, recorded in the studios of EMI St John's Wood, Abbey Road obviously, on Tuesday, November the 28th, 67, augmented applause recorded on location in Dublin. Using F8 filter at 33 ASA. So there's a little bit of Dublin on Christmas.
Did they just stop people in Dublin and ask them
to clap into a mic
in the street?
I don't know. Well, Dublin audiences are the best, aren't they?
They are the best. Well, they're second best.
Okay.
I do like this record, and I think the cover is a sort of collage that John and Ringo.
Yes, and Julian gets a shout out as a sleeve designer as well.
One of the things that I hadn't realised, what they do here is they have little jingles. So get Wanderlust for your trousers is one of the jingles. But
Wanderlust,
right? It's a sort of little narrative about turning up at BBC House. Victor Spinetti is on the record as the doorman at the BBC. But I always assumed that this came after The Who Sell Out,
right,
which is the record that features little jingles and pirate radio things and things like that. But
that comes out in December, doesn't it?
This was recorded before that came out.
Right.
So my question to the ether is, would the Beatles have heard or would they have been aware that that's what The Who were doing, or that there was a record about to come out that The Who Sell Out came out on the 15th of December.
Isn't it mad, just as a side point, as we're recording this, that The Who are putting a new album out? Imagine if the Beatles were putting a new album out.
Yes.
It's all very...
I haven't heard it, but it's getting 5-star reviews.
I have heard it.
Moving on.
But, you know, the big thing at Christmas, as I said, though, is Magical Mystery Tour. And that's due to be premiered on the BBC on Boxing Day. But what happens, obviously, in the preamble to that is the first new material in the wake of the sad death of Brian Epstein at the end of the summer. And that takes the form of two things. So the Beatles never wanted to do one thing when they could do two things, put out a standalone single of Hello Goodbye, which is backed with I'm the Walrus. But I'm the Walrus is also part of the other thing they put out, which is a 6-track double EP to go along with Magical Mystery Tour.
Which is something I've never understood.
Why
is I'm the Walrus?
Why is that on the B-side? Well, I've never understood why they felt the need to put out a single. If they're doing Magical Mystery Tour as their thing for the year, surely that was enough to get attention. Why would they be in competition with themselves? Because the reality is then, for number one at Christmas 67, you have Hello Goodbye at number one, and you have the Magical Mystery Tour double EP sitting at number two.
At this stage they had a number of unreleased songs that could have been put on the B-side of Hello Goodbye, but they sort of double up, and I've never really heard anyone comment on that or ask why.
Yeah, I don't know either. And the UK album that was number one for Christmas 67 was?
Is it something by the Monkees?
No. That was in 66 they were starting to get some
money. Sound of Music or Val Doonigan?
Val Doonigan rocks, but gently. But interestingly... Sergeant Pepper goes back to number one in January 68. We kind of think of it as a strictly 67 record, but even in January 68, Sergeant Pepper is still number one.
Well, I know I know there were only 4 or 5 records got to number one. There was Pepper, the Monkees had 2, and Val Doonigan.
US, Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn and Jones Limited by the Monkees is number one, and what a super album that is. I'm saying that unironically. Magical Mystery Tour, the US album that did not come out in the UK, did get to number one in the USA from January the 6th, 1968.
See, they should put I Am the Walrus on that album twice.
Well, yes, it does. Yes, on the B-side as well.
The other thing that's happening is Apple.
Yes, the boutique.
The boutique. So at the beginning of December, there's a launch party on the 5th of December. For the boutique that's opening in Baker Street, and John and George turn up. Paul is on holiday in Scotland. Ringo is in Italy filming his part in Candy, so the launch party, the shop opens on the 7th, and Paul says, this is going to be a beautiful place where beautiful people can buy beautiful things or shoplift
or steal
beautiful things. So that was the start of, if you like, the Beatles doing something that's not music or music related, and they're moving into this notion of Apple.
Yes, it might be the first time that the public become aware of that word Apple being associated with the Beatles.
And of course there's that very famous, very impressive multi-psychedelic
mural
which lasts about 2 weeks before the other people in the street say we can't stand this, and it has to be painted over. They weren't groovy people.
Groovy cats, if only we had it now. So as I said, the Magical Mystery Tour EP comes out that same week that the Apple Boutique opens. And what's interesting is we don't sometimes have a sense of how big these things sold, but the Magical Mystery Tour double EP in the UK had sold 600,000 copies by January 1968. And, we probably might do an episode about the EPs generally in the future, because we don't tend to have a sense about they were big sellers. They were huge EP, the Beatle EPs.
Yes,
in
the UK, this was, I never really understood, what was going on with EPs, not specifically Magical Mystery Tour, but you think, well, these are songs that they're pulling off albums. We know that kind of trope about the Beatles don't put out singles that are on albums, but the EPs are effectively 4 songs generally culled from an album. But the idea, I think, was still this notion that teenagers, the target market, they don't have the money for albums, so you pick the 4 sort of most popular songs off a particular album, you put it out as an EP, and that allows the teenagers
to buy those songs. So all was looking well on Christmas Day 1967. Yep. The public were listening to the Magical Mystery Tour album. They were looking forward to the Christmas special. On Christmas Day, Paul McCartney announces his engagement to Jane Asher.
Yes, the romance of the decade.
It all seems to be going...
Everything's going well.
Everything's going well. And then on Tuesday, the 26th of December 1967, on BBC One at 8:35, in glorious black and white, having been edited down to 55 minutes from 10 hours of ad hoc footage, the BBC One premieres the Magical Mystery Tour film. And I would hate to think, if Twitter had been around at that time, what the feedback might have been at the time. But it seems to cast a long shadow, that initial broadcast, because the next day, Knives are out, reviews are bad, and...
Yep, it's panned, absolutely panned. I don't think there's anything... I've got some comments here from newspapers at the time. So the Daily Express said, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, and what a fall it was. The whole boring saga confirmed a long-held suspicion that the Beatles are four rather pleasant young men who have made so much money they can afford to be contemptuous of the public. The Daily Sketch, where is the Daily Sketch? whoever authorised the showing of the film on BBC One should be condemned to a year squatting at the feet of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Well, George would be fine with that.
Some people protested, said The Sun, that the programme was incomprehensible.
Well, look, the BBC, in their defence, paid £10,000 apparently for the rights to show the show, and they did not ask for any kind of pre-screening.
Yeah.
Director General at the time basically said, how much do you want? I will clear a spot in the schedule. I'm not going to say no to an exclusive Beatles bit of Christmas telly. What isn't reported is that it was the most watched programme on British television on Christmas 1967. It's 20 million people watched it. And, we're still watching it today.
Yeah.
I'm not, and again... Maybe Magical Mystery Tour itself is a podcast episode. I'm not here to defend it. It's certainly ropey, but it has its moments, and we're glad it exists. And it's a thing that still stands up. You're giving me a slightly scathing look.
It has its fans, of whom I am one.
Okay,
I say it's maybe it definitely is a whole podcast in itself. But I watched it again when it came out. It was shown on Arena.
Yes.
Whenever the remastered Blu-ray set came out, and I sat down and watched it with my mother, and who I have to say was a big fan of the Goons.
Okay,
she loved it.
So she got it.
She got it. It's indulgent. But I think it stands up. I think it's worth, if anyone hasn't seen it,
it's definitely worth
seeing. Didn't get a release in America.
That is true.
Principally because of this backlash.
Yes.
So it wasn't scheduled to be sort of shown on Boxing Day or anything, but it was going to be sold to America. And they didn't touch it.
And as memory serves, it turns up in cinemas as a supporting feature in the early 70s.
In America in particular, there was this kind of college
circuit.
And it was a regular screening there.
That might have been the best way to see it.
And, the other, I forget which Monty Python film it was, but there's Eric Idle says about, or Michael Palin says about going to, they were given a screening.
I think it went out with And Now for Something Completely Different, I think.
It didn't actually go out, okay. But it was offered to them.
Right.
And they thought, this will be great. And I think it's Palin recounts going to a sort of private screening and thinking, well, we'll not bother. That's fine, as you were. So, but if it had gone out, I think it might have a better reputation.
But it does interrupt Paul McCartney's Christmas, because the next day, Wednesday, the 27th of December, he goes on television to the Frost programme to be interviewed by David Frost, which is on the evening. It's recorded in the evening between 6 and 7, and it goes out between 10:30 and
This is an amazing thing.
It's an odd interview. And what's interesting is Frost introduces him as saying, here is the man most responsible, Mr. Paul McCartney,
yeah.
Saying it's not a Beatles thing, it's a Paul thing.
Yes, I thought that's a very interesting introduction, that whether the other Beatles said to him, right, this is your idea,
you go on and do this.
But the very idea that Paul McCartney would come, the day after and sort of subject himself and feel that he had to go and sort of sit down in front of the British public and explain himself or explain the band. You sort of wonder, was there any discussion about, will we send Ringo? George? Will we send John? Well, we can't send John. God knows what he'll say. Or did Paul kind of, in a sort of knee-jerk defense of things, say, this is a great film, I'm going to go on and do this.
Yes. And he does say a couple of perceptive things. So he does say, I won't do my Paul voice, but he says, if you watch it a second time, it does grow on you. And this is one thing we forget, because when you make a record, a lot of people listen to our records and say, well, I don't like that one, But the second time around, they say, not bad. And then after a few plays, you know, open brackets, that they like the song. So I think that's a good point. It does, you know, Magical Mystery Tour isn't a linear narrative film. It's something that's got lots of little fun visual cues. It was undermined by being shown in black and white. It's much better in colour.
Yeah.
But it does.
And I think in that sense, that's I think that's exactly right what you've just said there about it. It's not a linear narrative. It's lots of little sort of not even interconnected. I mean, the whole idea of a bus trip is just a, you know, very flimsy structure. But in that sense, it does prefigure Python, even sort of things like, you know, the Fast Show or Vic Reeves or all of that kind of slightly odd British English.
But even the stuff that comes out today, video albums, you know, if this was, you know, people doing like, oh, so-and-so has a new album out and there's going to be like a Netflix special with an hour long cut of some of the tracks, you'd be like, fine.
You know,
it's just people, again, didn't really know what to do with
this. I think that's it. I think it was so different in terms of that narrative point.
Yes.
But also so different from the kind of Bruce Forsyth, Val Dunigan, Christmas,
kind of
Morecambe and Wise, mums and dads all sit down and watch. You know, it was just, but it secured a 20 million
audience.
Which you think the BBC would be happy with that?
Absolutely. I'm sure they were fine at the end of the day. And it was repeated a few days later in colour on BBC Two, because that was the only colour channel in the UK at the time. Paul McCartney did say one other interesting thing in that interview. Well, he said lots of interesting things, but the thing I highlighted was, he said, because in about a year or two, these things that don't look like successes will look a bit more like successes, you know, as people get into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he actually said,
I think he's right.
I think he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And he said the exact same thing in defense of McCartney, his debut album.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in defense of Give My Regards to Broad Street.
No, there's nothing that can be said. Well, maybe there is something that can be said in defense of Give My Regards to Broad
Perhaps
Street.
Perhaps enough time hasn't passed yet.
No. But so that's 1967. Let's carry on into December 1968. And in December 1968, they are still the biggest band in the world. They are selling copious amounts of copies of the White Album, which is number one in the UK and in the US. That came out at the end of November. Number one Christmas single in 1968 is Lily the Pink by The Scaffold. That's Paul McCartney's brother. And number one in the US for Christmas 68 is Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine. But interestingly, Hey Jude had been number one right up until December 1968 in the US. It had been number one for a long time.
And Two Virgins by John and Yoko didn't make the number one spot.
Didn't really, no. It was pipped at the post. And but there's a lot of stuff that's kind of happening that in retrospect we now know was, you know, maybe clouds on the horizon. You know, Apple as a business is open, but it's starting to burn through money. It's going through its chaotic pre-Alan Klein phase. And George Harrison sends a memo out at the start of December 68 about some Christmas visitors.
Yeah, so he'd been in California and met some Hell's Angels. So, as you do. So he was out there producing Jackie Lomax's LP for Apple, but he said to the Hell's Angels, oh, yeah, you know, you must swing by Apple when you get the chance. So at the beginning of December, he sends a little memo saying, you know, these Hell's Angels will be in London. They're on their way to sort out Czechoslovakia, that situation. And he said, they may look as if they're going to do you in, but they're very straight and do good things. So don't fear them or uptight them. It's like a hippie speak. Try to assist them without neglecting Apple business and without letting them take control of Savile Row. So he clearly had a notion that might be on the and indeed. They did arrive.
But it wasn't too. They then left again.
Well, they well, there's the Apple Christmas party takes place.
Yes.
And there's some great photographs
of John and Yoko.
John and Yoko dressed as kind of, you know, mother and father Christmas. And the story is, you know, the Hell's Angels are still there.
Yes.
There have been attempts by some Apple staff to sort of get them to move along, but the food arrives, including a turkey, and the Hell's Angels just descend on the food and devour everything and kind of disrupt the Apple Christmas party. But eventually George is the one that goes and says, you know, very nicely, enough is enough.
Yes.
Off you go. Go and sort out Czechoslovakia. They're possibly still
and
there.
And they did, and
eventually,
that was all fine.
Eventually, yeah.
The other thing that happens roughly the same time is Tuesday the 10th of December and Wednesday the 11th of December 68 is that John is involved with Yoko at the Rolling Stones, the recording of the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, which doesn't see the light of day until the mid-90s. But he records famously a version of Your Blues, which is from the just-released White Album with his new supergroup, The Dirty Mac. And again, this is a harbinger of Plastic to go, no band, going to Toronto kind of thing.
I think that's what that's what's fascinating for me is this is John stepping outside the Beatles and on a live stage, with Yoko.
Yes.
So as you say, there's a supergroup pulled together, which is John, Yoko, Eric Clapton, Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and Keith Richards on bass. So Bill Wyman still occasionally, or certainly when he was still giving interviews, still referenced how annoyed he was that Keith was so determined to be part of this that Bill was kind of ousted and Keith picked up the bass.
Right. And there's recently been a reissue of that, and there's a kind of a slight rehearsal take of John doing Revolution. It's interesting that was a possibility.
It was under consideration. That is because you kind of think, well, that's more in keeping perhaps with the Stones' Street Fighting Man, Sympathy for the Devil, that was going on around that.
And as you mentioned fleetingly earlier on, it's the first Christmas with Yoko. So
yes,
you know, we've had John has just put out Two Virgins with himself and Yoko in the nip on the cover.
Yeah.
And you know, Yoko is they're becoming the John and Yoko couple, and they do kind of some underground stuff at Christmas as well. They do an underground gig, don't they, the week before Christmas?
Yeah. What I would say is this wasn't released but at the time, but if it had been, it would have been interesting to see what the public reaction would have been to Yoko's performance on
the Rock and Roll Circus.
Rock and Roll Circus. There's a track where she does, which is just kind of a jam with Yoko screaming over the top of it. Liam Gallagher and I think it's great. and it's variously called Whole Lot of Yoko.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Or Her Blues.
Right.
But again, I think the clip of that is on YouTube. And you kind of think if that had suddenly been on the nation's television screens, what the reception?
Well, the other kind of parallel what if is, imagine if in the wake of the White Album the Beatles had decided to film performances of a bunch of songs in December 1968 from that album, because there was something in the ether at the time that they were going to do some performances.
Yes,
the Roundhouse in Camden was rumoured to be booked for three nights.
This is the sort of lead in to the Get Back, Let It Be project, with this idea that, you know, the White Album had been a sort of slightly stripped back, or quite stripped back, compared with Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour, and they'd left the psychedelic stuff behind,
and it could have been performed live. There's a bunch of tracks.
There's a lot of it on the box set that came out of the White Album. You know, you've got the Isha demos, but you've also got studio takes where they're performing as a group.
Yep.
And interestingly, Your Blues is one of the songs that they did
tightly as
effectively
a band,
as a group. So yeah, it was a possibility. So you've got Lennon performing live, and then McCartney really pushing this idea for the next project. You know, we've got to get back into the clubs. Let's write new songs, perform them live, record it, and
which is what they start 10 days after Christmas in January 69. If we look at the Christmas 68 record, though, again, with the benefit of hindsight, you can tell that something is amiss, because this then is another kind of right turn as far as the Christmas records go. It's the Beatles' sixth Christmas record. It says Happy Christmas, but it's recorded separately. They do not record it together. And if I read the notes on the back, it says, recorded in November 1968 at the lush London homes of Beatle John and Beatle Paul, and in the back of Beatle Ringo's diesel-powered removal van somewhere in Surrey, the voice of Beatle George is heard because yours faithfully, the GPO, did something right and joined up 6,000 miles of telephone links at an appropriate moment. Additional material was recorded earlier at the elegant Esher home of Beatle George during rehearsal sessions for the Beatles LP album set. So stuff from the Esher demos time. And famously, the producer of this is... went on to be, he was at the time, Kenny Everett.
Yes.
But went on to greater fame as a DJ and comedian and presenter and all-round legend, really. And he's listed on the back as non-Beatle Kenny for Everett.
And one of the things here is Yoko is on this.
Yes.
So quite a significant presence on this. So John is effectively recording little tracks. One of the most interesting things that he does here is that poem, Jock and Yono.
Right.
So Yoko is playing the piano, and he is reciting a poem that really sounds as if it could be on one of his books. But there's a line in there saying, they battled on against overwhelming oddities, including some of their beast friends. And that, I think, is the reference to the hostility that they perceived, that John in particular perceived, from the other Beatles. And Harrison in particular was very aggrieved that that line was there and that this was going out, whether he knew beforehand or not, but he certainly commented that, you know, he took exception to that.
Yes.
McCartney is actually performing little acoustic numbers.
Yes, he is, actually.
Which you kind of think, you know, they're hark back to the Escher demos. My favourite is George's very... Well, here we are. It's another Christmas. Christmas hasn't been here since, well, this time last year. He's clearly not engaged at all. And he turns most of his allotted time over to Tiny Tim.
Yes.
Who does the oddest version of Nowhere Man you'll ever you'll ever hear. But you kind of think it's all for the punchline. I think where George, once he finishes, says, "Thank you and God bless you, Tiny Tim," which is a sort of
a Christmas carol. So that's Christmas 68. That leads us to the last Christmas we're going to discuss today, Christmas 1969. And the change from 68 to 69 is again remarkable because the Beatles are essentially done. They've had their last day in the studio together. Abbey Road has come out. They are on precarious terms professionally and personally. They're still due to do the I Me Mine session that we discussed in a previous episode in January 1970. But by the end of 1969, it's very fractious. And if we stick on the Christmas records for a second, there is still, though, Beatle business to be done. Yeah. There is a seventh Beatles Christmas record. It is the final one. So, you know, you could be a Beatles fan at the end of 1969, getting your Beatles fan club record of new and exclusive material and think, well, something's happening.
All is well.
All is well. But again, it's recorded separately. It says on the back, you know, from Ascot in Berkshire, from Raybridge in Surrey, from St. John's Wood in the borough of Marylebone. John Paul, Ringo Poe and George send you these tapes of love and greetings by the Iron Wrist of Morris Cole, which is Kenny Everett's real name. The Beatles wish all of you a happy Christmas and may the 70s give peace a chance. And but, you know, it wasn't to be.
Again, everybody's doing their own thing.
Yes.
It's even more sort of fragmented. But as you say, if you received this at the time, it was the same idea as the previous one. It's kind of little things linked together.
Yeah.
Interestingly, this time, George barely contributes.
He's hardly, I think he just says one word or something.
He basically says, you know, Happy Christmas. This is George Harrison wishing you all a Happy Christmas. Yeah. It's 5-6 seconds tops.
He's more noticeable in Life of Brian.
Yeah. Ringo is plugging the Magic Christian film. Paul is doing another little acoustic ditty, and most of it is taken up with John and Yoko sort of wandering around a garden talking and
yeah, it's Kenny very Apple. John and Yoko.
It's
heavy.
Very John and Yoko. But again, it reflects where they all were, what was happening at the time.
One thing I'm very struck about when you take the seven Beatles Christmas records together, and this is noticeable from the box set from a few years back, if you look at the seven separate sleeves, they cover, as well as anything, the kind of the change in optics and art and presentation of the 1960s as anyone else, because it kind of starts with very formulaic showbiz type pictures, and then it goes into photo collage, very kind of mod 60s design, and then the very last one is kind of a blurry photo of Christmas lights. It looks like the War on Drugs' new album, you know. It's kind of got that kind of, if you told me this was some kind of new American indie group, I would believe you, with a doodle from future Who drummer Zach Starkey on the back. So if you kind of take those, you know, it's kind of a parallel history of the Beatles, those seven records, from Chirpy Chappies to, you know, deeply creative individuals through to fractious, can't even be in the same room type people. It's well worth taking in that way. What's interesting, at the end of 69, you know, Paul has kind of disappeared off the map, and we talked before how he was in Scotland and he comes back to London for Christmas. Ringo premieres his Magic Christian movie in December 69, but there's an awful lot of John and Yoko in 69.
This is fascinating to me, that if you actually look at a sort of a diary of what's happening from the 1st of December to the end of the month, there's a huge amount happening. The final Beatles book, the monthly fan club magazine, is published in December 1969, which again seems, you know, they were slightly ahead of the curve there in that everything was winding down. So that's absolutely an end point for that. John and Yoko are being filmed for documentaries. They're working on their own solo project. So there's another, people will be hoping this gets a re-release at some point. There's a fourth unfinished music record, one side of which was them laughing and one side of them was them whispering.
Right.
So that was recorded but not released. It's in the can. We're all hoping that that'll be a box set of that. So they're still working on their projects. They're making films.
They make a film called
Apotheosis.
Apotheosis.
Yeah, I have to read that to be able to say it.
Which is just a balloon journey. But yeah, it's the movie about the movie that's interesting.
Yes, it's the movie about the movie, and this is on YouTube. There's a little kind of documentary footage of them going to a village, and there's a hot air balloon, and they get into the basket with a hot air balloon, and then off camera, they get out of the balloon.
The camera goes up.
But the camera stays in. But there's this kind of notion that perhaps John and Yoko are sort of several miles up in the sky. The movie itself is only sort of 18, 19 minutes long, and it kind of the balloon is filming as it goes up through and bursts through the cloud cover. But this is the kind of thing, if you were John Lennon, you could get the funding by just picking up the phone. The war is over.
poster campaign starts 50 years ago this month, in this
December, but they're flying to Toronto to they're meeting the Pierre Trudeau from Canada, the Canadian Prime Minister, and so their campaign and the John and Yoko brand is
very
all
strong.
Over the place. The Beatles at this stage, there's a lot of remixing of tracks for the Hey Jude compilation. One track that I hadn't heard until I started sort of researching this is a new version of Octopus's Garden.
Right.
So Ringo is appearing on a TV special, and for union-related, musicians' union reasons, ban on miming, he couldn't just mime along to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they stripped some of the Beatles' instrumentation off and got session men to play over the top of it so that it was sufficiently different.
Is that out there, that version?
It's on YouTube.
Okay.
I had never heard it until quite recently, but I was scouring through bootlegs of Abbey Road sessions and suddenly this is there. So, I mean, it's a very insipid arrangement, and it reminds me of those occasions when, you know, much later in the 70s where people would, you know, punk and you would go on to Top of the Pops, but it would be the BBC orchestra would be playing some new wave record. It's a very odd because is it a Beatles record? I mean, it's got them on it, and then I'm back to thinking, well, that's another track should have been on the Abbey Road box set. That's a whole other.
And the Plastic Ono Band Live Toronto album comes out just before Christmas, so that's recorded in September.
Yeah.
Famously, where Lennon decides to leave the Beatles in a whim, and here we are 3 months later, and it's out there.
It is, and I mean, if we go back to the Get Back sessions, the whole idea here is Paul is saying, let's play live, let's go, and you know, George is saying absolutely not. I mean, he kind of nixes that. Lennon is saying not interested, but yet, you know, building on the rock and roll circus the year before, he's played live in Toronto. He and Yoko do a gig at the Lyceum Ballroom on the 15th of December that we will be talking a little bit about. George is out touring with Delaney and Bonnie, just effectively as the guitar player in the back. He's touring. So
Paul doesn't get the message that we don't want to tour with you.
Yeah. So, but it's interesting. Paul doesn't do this. You know, presumably Paul could pick up an acoustic guitar and do a little tour.
But doesn't Lennon write to him about a year later saying, we've all been out playing live.
Yes.
Why aren't you playing live, Paul?
So it seems to me that it makes it very clear that Paul saw the live touring, the live performances, that was the way to keep the band together. He wasn't interested in doing live performances per se.
Okay. And then right at the end of the year, the John Lennon Man of the Decade TV special goes out, which has kind of been recorded over the previous weeks. But it's interesting because, you know, there's a great book that came out this year, And in the End, which kind of looks at breaks down their 1969. And it very nicely puts out the trajectory of how John and Yoko go from being sidelined in January 69 at the Let It Be sessions through to at the end of the year being media manipulators.
Yes.
Hugely famous as a separate entity to totally with a new identity from the Beatles. And, you know, this kind of documentary is part of that. I think it's a 20-minute segment. If I remember rightly, JFK and Mao Zedong are the other two people featured. So that's
good company.
Strange company to keep. And but it really draws a line under, no, this isn't the Beatles decade.
Yes.
Here's a
yes.
show about John Lennon and Yoko.
That's it. I mean, he is separate from this. And, and they are very focused. It's that where they start using the John and Yoko as a single word. And
it's out there as well if people want to watch it. So it's quite a trip, isn't it, Stephen? Those 10 Christmases from 1960 to 1969. We've gone from guys who, you know, couldn't get a break post-Hamburg through to being on top of the world. And, you know, it's interesting to see. It's, you know, it's often said, the Lou Reed quote of my week beats your year.
Yes.
The Beatles could get stuff done in a month that other people would take a year to do. Their years were like decades. That they just
it is. It's the speed.
Yeah.
It's the speed that these things are happening at, and also then the speed of the sort of the abrupt halt.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing. You're sort of rushing up to this decade, and as you say, suddenly they're fractured, and they're all doing their separate things, and 12 months on again, McCartney's serving a writ.
Yes. And maybe the Beatles' Christmases in the 1970s might be a future episode.
A future episode.
Or we can kind of break that down a little bit more. Okay, so listen, they are the Beatles' Christmases. Let us know what you think. Again, we are in the usual places. We're on Twitter, at BeatlesPod. We are on Facebook, at the Nothing Is Real group. If you knock on that door, Stephen might let you in. And if you want to leave a nice review or feedback on anywhere where you listen to your podcasts, we would be grateful for anything that you, any good reviews you might want to leave behind. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this is Nothing Is Real. Thank you for listening. Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.